This podcast is a member of the Place to Be Nation family. Visit us at placetobenation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
Listeners, is the luxurious, sensuous voice of Chris Isaak welcoming you to our very special Long Book Hunters on the Wicked and the Divine. You see how we pick our songs, we go off of the title, we try to explore the themes of the book, and I feel like Chris Isaak's Wicked Game is the best exploration of the themes of divinity in all of pop culture. All that being said, I'm Greg Phillips, your normal weekly host here, alongside my cohort, my partner in crime. Some call him the Clown Prince of Columbus, Georgia area. Nick Duke. Nick, how are you?
I think this week, let's just call me the Clown Prince of Cold Med, so this ought to be interesting.
Yes, you see, both Nick and I are feeling a little under the weather this week, and the thought crossed mind, should we just, you know, skip a week like we used to do in our old column days? But you know what? We weren't willing to do that because we Place to Be Nation listeners,
Greg. Let's get it
right.
Let's get it right.
We're all part of one family. We're all you listeners out there, we do this for you. We break our backs. We make ourselves humble.
Indeed.
For you. And
sometimes we even suck. Never mind.
No, we make ourselves humble and break our back for you, the listeners out there. And we take pride in being the longest running
weekly episodic
comic book
podcast in play
on the Place to Be Nation
pop
feed.
Yes,
that's right. We said it so slowly that we could actually say it along with each other, but we do take pride in that. So we're here battling the elements, battling our ailments, battling other kinds of mints out there to be here and to give you our message of comic book wisdom. And folks, we might be the most prepared for this episode of any episode we've ever done.
Yes, between the physical ailments, the medication cloud I'm hovering in right now, and our overwhelming amount of preparedness, this ought to be not just our best podcast yet, but the greatest podcast in the history of this planet.
That's right, or any other.
Or any other, for that matter.
That's right. Now, let's get right into the meat of things. You didn't come here to listen to us babble. You didn't come here to listen to me impersonate outdated celebrities from the 1960s. You came here to hear about comics. So we're going to hit you up with our favorite segment and yours, what you're reading, what you're watching. But here's the caveat to this. Neither of us is watching anything, and I didn't read anything this past week. The only thing I read this past week was our Long Book Hunters book of the week, The Wicked and the Divine. I didn't have time to read anything else. But Nick's read some stuff. Nick, tell him what you've read.
Tell him what you've read. So where should I start here? I'm confused.
Well, a little bit of hawk there for you, ladies and gentlemen. Sorry.
So where should I start?
Well, Quite frankly,
you tell
that's
me.
Not for me.
You tell. No.
Listen, you can't come. You ask me a question that I can't even answer. Do I work for the company? Hell no. Do I work for Nick Duke Enterprises? Hell no. How am I supposed to know what's going on in the inner workings of the Duke compound, folks? Listen, I can just offer my viewpoint from the outside going in. I might say, well, you should start with your number three book. Or hell, I might even say you should start with your worst book. Some might say you should start with your best book. Hell, there might even be some Francis that needs to lighten up that will say, why the hell don't you just start with your second book? Oh, that's real cute. That's real funny. That's real cute. Well, listen, folks, I ain't here to be cute. I ain't here to be cute. I'm here to do this damn podcast, sauce it, and talk to you every week about what I think, and that's my right. Or maybe it's not. That's not for me to say.
What book does Terry think I should start with?
Duke, you egg-sucking dog, you should start with me and my brother Dory, number two. You egg-sucking dog, you son of a bitch.
What about Stu?
Well, when you put him in the hammer like you did.
There was a brief bizarre moment there where your Terry and your Stu cross-pollinated with one another.
Yes. We briefly ended up with Stu Funk.
They briefly made the beast with two backs there for a moment.
Yes. It's weird because when I do the stew and when I do the Terry, I try to do them as JR doing
yes,
them.
Yes, the only way you can. Yes.
But it often leads to some confusion. But while I'm thinking about it, I'm going to go ahead and throw in a my boy.
I was about to say, speaking of Terry and Stew making the beast with two backs, I wonder what old Jim would think about that.
My boy, beautiful, marvelous.
Sounds more like Paul Lynde every time I do it.
We have gone off the rails already. What are we talking about?
We're talking about what you've read this week, sir.
What have I read this week?
We'll start with your number three book of the week. Have you read four or more books this week?
Hey, I got a surprise for you. I read all eight of my books this week.
What?
Yep.
There was a lot of trips to the throne in the Duke compound this weekend.
I pulled a late rally. It was impressive. So let's see how this goes. Number three book of the week. I got Wonder Woman number four. Greg Rucka continues to surprise, to not surprise, but impress on this title. This is the second issue of the year one storyline, giving you a glimpse at what Rucka's version of life on Themyscira is like. So very much enjoyed this one. Even the Nicholas Scott art, which I was a little iffy on in the first issue of this storyline, is starting to grow me a little bit, and it actually moves the story along a lot faster than I was expecting, as in, by the end of this issue, she has already been dispatched to be the ambassador to man's world. So, interesting plot movements going on here in this book. I highly recommend it. I'm sure you will have something to say about it.
Oh, yes. I'm very much digging this series.
In the coming weeks. My number two book of the week, I've got Batman Detective Comics, number 938. If you recall, the last time there was issued Detective Comics, it was my number one book of the week, and this just picks right up where that left off. And it has one of the trademarks that a great team book should always have, and that is every character on the team gets their moment, so to speak. Every character gets a moment where you go, man, that's a freaking cool character moment, and it makes you care about these characters even more, and it makes you realize just how cool this book is right now. So can't wait for you to read this one and get your thoughts more in depth on it. I will say, I know you're not as high on Cassandra Cain as I am, but I thought she had the most badass moment in this issue personally. So looking forward to getting your thoughts on that at some point down the road. But my number one book of the week, and this is a book that I gotta enjoy it while it's lasting, because I've only got one more issue now that this week is over. I'm going Darth Vader number 24 as my number one book of the week. And it is, you know, a Star Wars book, a comic, should always, you know, provide you with some great action, a little bit of humor and all that stuff. But where Darth Vader has surpassed all the other Star Wars comics, in my view anyway, is the way it tugs at your emotional heartstrings. And it certainly does that in this book. And essentially most of the book takes place inside Vader's head, where he's imagining the events from Episode 3, the final battle between he and Obi-Wan in Episode 3, if they had played out differently. And he has to basically confront his past and finally put to rest, or he thinks he's putting to rest once and for all the memory of Anakin Skywalker and who he once was. And there are some moments where he has to essentially force out certain memories and certain attachments he had out of his head, and it's, you can see the emotional anguish in pretty much every panel. It is a fantastic, fantastic read for people who are fans of the Darth Vader character.
Now, what did you think about Big Van Vader number 24?
Big Van Vader number 24 featured him going up against Will Ospreay, because he was doing too much flippy shit and it was pissing Vader off. So that was also good.
Very interesting. Have to keep up with that. What about your worst pick of the week, Nick? Do you have a bottom pick?
Yeah, I got a bottom pick, and this is kind of like Hellblazer from a couple weeks ago, like you were saying. It's a perfectly average comic. There's nothing wrong with it. It just means that I won't be buying any more of it, and I'm going with Deathstroke Rebirth. Fine book. Nothing overly wrong with it. Fine art, fine story, fine writing, but nothing that hooked me in any real way, I'll say. So that's my bottom book of the week. And then real quick, some quick hits. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps number 2 surpasses the number 1 issue, in my opinion. Continues to build the story in an intriguing fashion. Has some great Guy Gardner moments. And this book, Robert Venditti has just completely turned around his Hal Jordan writing, in my opinion. And this book is, is now knocking on my top 3. Or just missed the cut for my top 3 this week. So very, very good effort from Mr. Venditti here.
Let me ask you this. Is Guy Gardner somewhat attitudinal?
Somewhat attitudinal. I just hope he doesn't hit anybody so hard that it causes, well, anal bleeding.
Anal bleeding. Very good. Very good, Mr. Love.
Next up, I got All-Star Batman number 1. This was it's a good book, but I feel as if it suffered from overblown expectations on my part. Scott Snyder had promised his version of The Long Halloween. That was a comparison he made. He invited that comparison, and so my expectations were through the roof, and they were not met. But still, it was a good book, and John Romita Jr. does a good job here on art, in my opinion. Old Man Logan number 10, continuing the Last Ronin storyline. Kind of felt like a filler issue, honestly. Most of it takes place in one location. A lot of it is flashback to a villain I don't really know anything about.
Tell me the name of the villain. Tell me the name of the villain.
I can't remember, to be honest with you. It was a person who was in an organization called the Silent Order.
I don't know anything about that.
Okay, well, in any event, kind of felt like a stall issue a little bit, but still, because of the Sorrentino art, you know, it just was pretty as hell to look at, so I enjoyed this one a great deal as well. And then finally, Action Comics number 961 continues to move that storyline forward in an interesting way, although I will say the end of the book had a little bit too much of a Deus Ex Machina flavor for me, but I'll wait and see how you feel about it when you read it.
Very good. With all that out of the way, I, of course, have nothing to add, as I haven't read any weekly comics. And, as a warning, it may be a few weeks before I can. Actually, it may be the next, not the next episode, but the one after that, before I actually can, because that's when I get paid and will be able to buy things again. But that being, that notwithstanding, as someone might say, let's move on to the rundown. And we got a few hot-button items for you here on the rundown. We're going to start off with our main event headline of the rundown. This is the top of the fold, to use a little insider newspaper jargon, ladies and gentlemen. The number one story of the month, or at least of the week, rather, is that July 16th marked the first time in a very long time. I think it was 33 weeks, the first time in 33 weeks, perhaps, or 33 months, I should say, that DC was actually on top of the market share in comics for July 2016. The numbers came out this past week, and DC controlled 35.36% to Marvel's 34.20% in reshare or dollar share, and 41% to Marvel's 35% in unit share. So,
what does it all mean, Basil?
What does it all mean? It means that Rebirth is an unmitigated success at this point, at least to this point. It has been enough to launch DC back into the top of the food chain, which they haven't been since the beginning of the New 52, basically. So, you know, it's a very good thing. It's awesome. And yes, there is the natural inclination of, well, obviously you're going to get that with number one issues, but when you look into the numbers, there are a lot of number two and even number three issues that are holding strong in this Rebirth initiative, which is really, really impressive. Nick, your thoughts on this story, and what, if anything, do you think this story actually represents for DC Comics and for the comic industry as a whole?
I would caution against drawing too many conclusions about what it means just yet. You have to understand that Marvel is in the midst of a kind of a perfect storm that is allowing DC to do this, in that they have Civil War II, which hasn't been overwhelmingly well received, so naturally there's a sales slump there, but also they've pretty much announced that they're doing another relaunch, so to speak, in October. So for a lot of readers, they're sitting there going, well, why am I going to buy books or jump onto books when I know they're relaunching in October? I'll just wait until October. So let's see DC do this a couple of months, 2, 3, 4, 5, 6 months in a row before we you know, wave our DC fanboy flags a little, you know, very hard.
I'm looking at the numbers. I've got Comicron.com pulled up, folks. This is the resource for comic book sales information through Diamond Distributors, the best info that we have anyway, because Diamond has a monopoly, which is another topic we'll get to perhaps at another time. But I'm going to go ahead and run down these top 10 titles, and you know it's a good month when the number 16 selling title is moving over 100,000.
Yes.
That's Detective Comics at number 16, moving 100,626
copies. Which Detective Comics?
936.
Okay. Was 937 above or below that?
937 was below, but it was 92,172.
Okay, cool.
So here's your top 10, ladies and gentlemen. Number one, Justice League.
No, you go in the opposite order, Greg. Haven't you ever done countdown before?
All right, fine. Number 10. Okay, I'm going to start with number 11 because these two are tied in. Well, actually, I'll start with the first one because it was number 10. Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps Rebirth is the number 10 seller at 113,965 copies shipped.
Wow.
Meanwhile, the number one issue of Hal Jordan and the Green Lantern Corps is number 11 on this list, and it only dropped from 113,000 to 108,708. So you're talking about only a difference in, what, I'm not good at math, 5,000 copies, correct?
Yeah, somewhere around there.
Give or take. So that's pretty good for them to hold steady. Number nine, and boy, I'm really excited about this. Number nine, Nightwing number one. At 114,787, which has to be the highest selling Nightwing book of all time. I can't imagine.
I would assume so.
At least since
the '90s,
anyway.
Yeah, because the '90s, the market was a completely different beast, to say the least.
Right. So, that's got to be either at or near a record for Nightwing. I would assume the record, because even in the '90s, I don't think it was selling that good. New Superman number one is at number eight.
What?
Yep, at number eight, New Superman number one, and it shipped 117,684 copies. At number seven, Civil War II from Marvel. Number four.
Number four, okay.
At 126,865. There are only two Marvel titles in the top ten, both Civil War, and the last Civil War sold significantly less than the third one. According to these numbers, anyway. Nightwing Rebirth, number one, is at number six at 127,846, which, whatever I just said about the record for Nightwing number one, throw that out the window because it's Nightwing Rebirth number one. Batman number three is at number five at 168,939 copies shipped. Civil War II, number three, is at number four. God, that's confusing. 176,876 copies. Number three is Batman number two at 177,000 copies. I'm just going to estimate from here on out instead of using the full numbers. Number two is Justice League Rebirth number one at 177,000. And number one is Justice League number one at 209,000 copies.
Wow, the massive increase from the Rebirth to the number one on that. when the rebirth wasn't that impressive. Well, interesting.
Yep, very interesting. But the numbers that I'm most interested in is because obviously number ones are going to be inflated. I'm interested in Batman number 3 holding strong. Hey, it's Batman. We knew that that was
Batman was always, you know, a top 5 seller.
Exactly.
Pretty much.
I'm interested in Hal Jordan, the Green Lantern Corps number 1, Nightwing number 1. But here's the ones that are really interesting. Wonder Woman number 2. 103,759 copies shipped. Flash number 2, 103,000 copies shipped. Superman number 2, 101,000 copies. Superman.
And you know what's crazy about this?
Copies.
What's crazy about this is when you take into account the bi-monthly shipping schedule, that means they're shipping 200,000 Wonder Woman copies a month,
which is insane. Cuz I think I said when they first announced this that I thought this was going to hurt the bottom line numbers of the books but help the overall total. But it hasn't. It hasn't hurt them at all so far. It's actually helped them. It appears as if these titles that are selling like gangbusters. I'm looking down the list. Here's the most promising thing to me. Green Arrow number 3 actually outsold Green Arrow number 2. Yeah, Green Arrow number 2.
What did it move?
Say what?
What did those issues
Green Arrow number 2 moved 72,849. Green Arrow 3 moved 72,864.
And Green Arrow was selling what? Around
20 something thousand.
15 to 20,000 pre.
Yep.
Yeah.
I mean, we're talking huge increases. Green Lanterns 2 and 3 holding strong at about 78,000. They just dropped from 82,000 to 78,000, but it's maintaining that level. And again, the Green Lantern titles were just a disaster heading into Rebirth in terms of sales. All of them. Action Comics 960 at 75,000. Action Comics was moving around 29,000 before Rebirth. It's been a success so far. We'll see if they can maintain the momentum. But do you know why I think these books are selling so well, Nick? It's not because of the big initiative, because if the initiative had started out strong and the quality wasn't there, you'd see these books tapering off. It's the fact that there's been really good quality.
Yeah, it's the quality. That's what it is. Yeah, absolutely. It was a variety of factors. It was getting people in the door with the low price point. DC essentially got their foot in the door with readers who were willing to try some stuff out, and then they stayed for the quality. I mean, that's what it's got to be. I can't think of anything else that it would be.
No, I think that's exactly it. And I'm hoping that the message is gonna stick, that people are ready for a change and they're ready for a little bit of thinking outside of the box, so to speak.
Are you saying enough is enough and it's time for a change?
That's exactly what I'm saying. I'm also saying that Phillips 316 says, "I just broke your neck." So...
You are quite the nugget.
Well, quite frankly, I'm the king of all hard-traveling fanboys.
The king of nuggets.
Our next topic on the rundown is Civil War II has been delayed and added an extra issue as well. However, Brian Michael Bendis offered a pretty solid explanation for that, Nick.
He did indeed, and I will tell you what it is.
He says, I'll go ahead and beat you to that. He basically explained that David Marquez, who is the artist, just had a baby. He didn't have a baby. his wife had a baby. And so, you know, it's kind of bad to ask him to draw a comic book while you've just got a newborn baby. So they're making a little bit of a delay for that. They also felt he needed the extra space for another issue. He said he came up with a better ending but needed the extra pages. So, to me, this is no big deal, really. I mean, it happens. It's not nearly as bad as the Secret Wars delays that happened. So, what do you think, Nick?
Well, it's just an interest trend at Marvel right now. Their big event books are seeming to run into delays, and then their response to those delays is to add issues, which seems like a really weird thing to do. They did it with Secret Wars number 8, or the Secret Wars, and are doing it the same thing again with Civil War 2, so not really sure what
to make
of this.
And let's hope that this doesn't conflict with their big planned relaunch that they're doing out of this, because that was a big issue, as I understand it, coming out of Secret Wars, is that their relaunch titles started while Secret Wars was still going on. So,
oh yeah, they had had relaunch titles, I want to say, in September of last year, and Secret Wars didn't wrap up until December or January, if I'm not mistaken. So, pretty substantial overlap there, you know, between the two.
Yes. But other than that, I don't really have a whole lot to add to that. I mean, you know, Bendis at this point has kind of earned his keep at Marvel. So, you know, I'm glad
that you're damn right he has.
Letting him do his deal. Now, on to a completely different topic, off the comics medium for a moment. Let's go into the world of film and talk about the somewhat maligned Suicide Squad, which we reviewed right here.
Somewhat unique, some might say.
Yes, we reviewed right here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys last week. There's the director, David Ayer, came out and kind of explained a few details about the film, but the one that we want to focus on is the backstory of his vision and his version of the Joker, which we should point out was never at all even hinted at in the movie that we saw.
It is another, it's very similar to the Ultimate Edition in that, into the Ultimate Edition of Batman v Superman, that is, in that if this was supposed to be part of the story, then make it part of the freaking story. Don't leave these things out if they're concepts that are important to who these characters are, and especially this concept that we're about to talk about, which would explain the somewhat unique aesthetic of the Joker in the DC Extended Universe.
Yeah, I'll go ahead and read the quote from David Ayer that he gave to Empire about this, and basically what he says is, as you know, a big part of this movie's marketing, before, this is not his quote, a big part of this movie's marketing was about the Joker's look, Jared Leto's look. Why does he have the damaged tattoo that everybody thought looked stupid? Why does he have a grill, which everyone thought looked stupid? Why does he have, you know, just in general, this very, I don't know what you would call it, this very almost trendy look about him? Well, here's what David Ayer has to say about that. Quote begins now. Quote, "This is sort of my personal thing and maybe less about a larger connection. But Joker killed Robin and Batman basically smashes his teeth out and locks him up in Arkham Asylum. It's in the asylum where Joker would have done the damage tattoo as a message to Batman saying, 'You've damaged me. I was so beautiful before and now you've destroyed my face.' And that's where the grill comes from as well." End of quote. Okay, that sounds good to me. That sounds, yep, that sounds like a perfectly good explanation. The Joker would absolutely do that. And yep. Batman knocking out Joker's teeth, perfect. All that sounds great. But again, here's the problem. Yep. None of it is in the movie.
Not even kind of.
Nope. Not even in it.
Not even like hinted at, nope, so that you could, you know, put it together on your own if you tried. Like, it's just not in the movie
at
all.
And here's the other problem with it. Okay. As you remember, in Harley Quinn's title card sequence, it flashes up and says that she confessed to the murder of Robin. So either she was actually involved in it, or what we all think is the case, she just took credit for it to try to deflect blame from the Joker, most likely. However, there's still a big problem in all that. The murder of Robin is what led Batman to beat up the Joker, which led the Joker to get the damage tattoo. But in the flashback in Suicide Squad, when Harleen Quinzel is first meeting the Joker, he already has the damage tattoo.
Yep. I mean, it's, as we discussed last week, the plotting and structure of that movie was a mess. So I'm not surprised that there's a lack of internal continuity even within David Ayer's own thought process here. So,
but not
surprising.
But
to me.
Nick, it's not for us to say.
It's not for us to say. You know, some might say that the talent in those films, it was their job to execute the play that was called. You can't get mad at the creative folks. Sometimes it's the talent's fault.
That's right. You know, everybody wants to be critical of creative or critical of the boss, the man up top. be critical and say, oh, well, Vince should have done this. Vince should have done that. Sometimes it falls on the talent, ladies and gentlemen. It falls on the Will Smiths. Perhaps he got into the dreaded comfort zone, ladies and gentlemen. But I digress. That's not for me to say. That's for somebody else to say. Some might say. Now,
actually, I'm going to throw you a curveball here,
like
Greg.
Curveballs. Go ahead.
I'm throwing you a curveball. I'm going off format, folks. This is not on the format sheet. While we're on the topic of what some might say, why don't we talk about what some might what some Warner Brothers employees may or may not have said at any point in the past in a possible open letter
that may or may not have been written.
That may or may not have been written to Warner Brothers CEO Kevin Tsujihara.
You really just wanted to say his name, didn't you?
Well, that, and I wanted to talk about this letter. It's a letter.
And as I understand it, it was posted on Punjab.com, correct?
Who is there that would like to read? That would like for Nick Duke to read this entire letter on the podcast?
Let me answer that for you. There is no one.
There is no one.
Go ahead, sir.
No, I'm not reading this letter.
I don't want you to read the whole letter, but just go ahead with whatever your point was, sir.
Was there a point? Let's see here. This letter that we're talking about, it made the rounds on the old interwebs. I'm sure you probably saw it. Maybe you did. Maybe you didn't. Once again, not for me to say. But the general point of it seemed to be that it was written by a person who was claiming to be someone who had worked on the upcoming film Wonder Woman.
Someone who works in the industry,
yes. In our business. In our genre, if you will. In any event, this person is alleging that basically Wonder Woman is a mess because Warner Brothers is meddling in the film the same way they meddled in Batman v Superman and Suicide Squad. And basically the general gist of the letter is that it's blaming Zack Snyder and Kevin Tsujihara for everything wrong with the DC Extended Universe. And I'm sure I'm missing some nuance in there that Greg is gonna highlight right now.
Yes. I don't have the letter in front of me. I'm going off of memory. But what the person who took the fake name Gracie Law, which I believe is from Big Trouble in Little China, to write the letter, claims is that they were a former employee of Warner Brothers. But in the midst of it the reason why many are doubting the validity of the letter is because it's not written like someone who actually knows how movies are made. It's written like someone who is a fanboy or fangirl and is written in such a way that it's basically listing off movies they don't like as reasons why the studio is a big failure. For instance, perhaps the biggest black mark, and I have to admit, I read it on Twitter from someone else, but they credited it to the dreaded, whose name I dare not mention usually, but Devin Farisee brought this point up, that in the open letter, she makes a point about how Warner Brothers hasn't had a number one hit in so long or what have you, hasn't had a critical darling other than she fails to mention Mad Max Fury Road, which was nominated for an Oscar for Best Picture. But also, the studio's last big, giant, blockbuster success was 2014's American Sniper by Clint Eastwood, who she in the article takes Warner Brothers to task for making the movie Jersey Boys, which was directed by Clint Eastwood. So she takes them to task for allowing Jersey Boys to be made by the same guy who made the last number one smash hit for Warner Brothers, and a guy who has won more Oscars than Joss Whedon has movies. Not most likely an insider.
Well, I can't. It's not for me to say whether or not the person is an insider. Quite frankly, that's up to you. You have to make that determination whether or not you believe it.
And by
but,
you, he means the listeners at home.
Indeed. But I will say this. While I don't necessarily buy that the letter is real, I'm not entirely convinced that it might not be right in some aspects on accident, if that makes any sense. In that, I said last week on our show that I felt sorry for Patty Jenkins. Because, if anything, Warner Brothers has proven that they will be overly reactionary to critical response, and they will drastically alter films that are in production as an overcorrection to that, you know, to that response. And it would not surprise me in the least right now if that movie is being meddled with, if it's being pulled out of her control, and being hacked to shreds, because that's what they did with Suicide Squad. So, do I buy the letter? Not necessarily. Do I buy the idea that Wonder Woman could turn out to be a train wreck? Yes, I absolutely think that's a real concern that it could happen.
Well, they have to.
At this point, as I said before, DC movies are going to have to show me a legitimately great movie before I'm going to sit here and go, you've earned my benefit of the doubt. Right now, I have no faith left, Greg, is where I'm at.
Oh, I feel that. I think, you know, something like this doesn't really help much, but I think that it automatically gets people to think that this is true. I mean, you know how comics internet is. They're going to think that it's true if it's reported at all. So, you know, it's unfortunate that so many sites picked up on it. But I do understand where you're coming from. I understand that Warner Brothers has done nothing to earn our good faith, has done nothing to earn our benefit of the doubt. So I feel you on that. But I don't think it's fair to the people that worked on this movie to judge a movie that, you know, is so far out, you know, so far from actually being released. I mean, we've heard other movies in production that were rumored to be messes turn out to be classics, you know. I think I read online that Guardians of the Galaxy, when it was in production, had a leaked thing from top-level executives that were terrified about it because they thought it was a mess, and then it came out and it was awesome. So, you know, it happens. Hopefully, you know, I forget saying hopefully. I don't know if it's going to be good or not. It hopefully will be, but I don't know. But you're right. We don't need to give them the benefit of the doubt. They have not earned that. They've lost that. We gave them the benefit of the doubt for the last 3 years, and they've lost it.
That's right. Amen, that's right.
Quite.
Oh, God, here we go.
Ladies and gentlemen,
hmm.
That was the Ho-Ho Loon ticker going off here on the Hard Traveling Fanboys. Let's take you to the Ho-Ho Loon Control Center. Nick, do you have our update on Ho-Ho Loon's status in the WWE Cruiserweight Classic?
You know, I do, but I'm actually going to let you do the read this week due to my somewhat inebriated cold medicine state.
Understandable. Well, I'm getting indications, ladies and gentlemen. Yes, it's confirmed. Adam Schefter has just texted me. ESPN's Adam Schefter has confirmed Ho-Ho Loon still alive in the WWE Cruiserweight Classic. So the hopes of a nation still alive in the WWE Cruiserweight Classic.
I heard a rumor that he's going to be getting a new theme song as well, performed by Whispering Bill Anderson.
Hmm. Curiouser and curiouser.
Curiouser.
First down 10.
No flags.
This has been your Ho-Ho Loon update of the week. Back to your regularly scheduled hard-traveling fanboys. Yes, ladies and gentlemen. So let's get to the last news item of the rundown. Actually, we got two more items in the rundown. Let's get to your final two rundown items here. The first, ladies and gentlemen, is a great, great casting announcement for actually.
Let's stick with the films first, Greg. Before we go,
want to go there? Well, speaking of great casting, The Rock, as many of you know, Dwayne Johnson. Some call him other more heavenly names. He has long ago been cast to play Black Adam in a Shazam movie that often feels like it's never going to happen. However, The Rock's ex-wife slash manager slash production partner, Danny Garcia, recently gave an interview in which she revealed a little bit of an update on the Shazam movie, and pretty promising, I think, update. She said that this work is slow on it, but it's slow for a reason, that they want to get it right, and that it's going to be connected. This is the first time we've had confirmation that it is going to be in the DC Cinematic Universe, but it's going to be about as far removed from it as you can get without moving it out of that universe. She said it will be completely distinct in tone. Zack Snyder will not have anything to do with it. The people that are kind of doing that side of it will not have much to do with it. It's going to be its own thing in its own corner of the DC Cinematic Universe. Again, not a huge update, no timeline update on it, but they say it is going to happen. She said that they're committed to making it as good as it could possibly be and making sure that it has a unique feel and tone. Nick, your thoughts?
All sounds great. And you know, you and I are not Zack Snyder haters by any stretch of the imagination, but I think we would both agree that him not being involved with a project like Shazam is probably for the
best. Yes, absolutely, I agree. I'm not nearly as hard on Zack Snyder as many people are, but even I know that the guy has his things that he's good at, and he has his things that he's bad at, and I really don't want him anywhere near Shazam. So,
absolutely. All sounds great to me. Let's hope that that unique vision and that level of control they talk about is something that will be maintained throughout the entire process of making this movie.
Couldn't have said it better myself. We've got a couple of really good casting announcements, ladies and gentlemen, in the world of television, particularly the DC television universe, which is going a lot better than the cinematic universe so far. We've got the first one here. I'm going to start with the one that I'm least excited about out of the two. Lance Henriksen. Well-known, famous, popular actor, known for his role in Aliens and other movies, a lot of sci-fi movies, Terminator movies, or at least he was. You know, yeah, he's been in all these movies. He has joined the cast of Legends of Tomorrow, and he will be playing the son. Well, in the comics, the son of the original Green Lantern, Alan Scott. He probably won't be that in the TV universe, since there is no Alan Scott. But he will be playing Obsidian, who's a longtime foe, more often a foe of the Justice Society of America. And as you may know, Legends of Tomorrow will have the Justice Society in it this year, so it makes perfect sense that they go to Obsidian. Couldn't pick a better guy to play a villain in a DC show.
Will he be a villain, though? We don't know.
Well, that's a good point. Quite frankly, he may start as a member of the team for all we know.
May end up as a member of the team. May start as a villain. We don't know.
May not even be in the show for all we know, even though they said he...
I for one, hope that he is Alan Scott's son, mainly because if he's this old and he's Alan Scott's son, that means we're one step closer to getting that overly geriatric version of the Justice Society that you and I have always wanted.
That's right. We want old men eating pudding. We want Martin Lawrence and Eddie Murphy at the end of life.
At the end of life, as the Justice Society. Yep. Yes. Cocoon.
Yes.
If you will.
I have a boner. anyway.
That wasn't a movie quote, by the way.
No, that was just
that was Greg just looking down and looking down and realizing the situation.
Thinking about geriatric Justice Society does that to me.
It's that Johnny Thunder that does it for
you.
That's
right. Now, moving on to the more exciting one for me. Oh, ladies and gentlemen.
Coming off his starring role in Kindergarten Cop 2.
Coming off his awesome show-stealing performances in all three Expendables movies as well, ladies and gentlemen. One of my favorite badasses in Hollywood. The Gargantuan himself. Ivan Drago himself. The Punisher himself. Dolph Lundgren.
Thomas Jane.
Who?
Oh. Never mind. You said the Punisher, so I said Thomas Jane.
Dolph Lundgren is joining the cast of Arrow this season to play the head of the Russian mafia.
Ed.
This happened, and I almost suffered a massive heart attack due largely to my blocked arteries. However, I'm sure that the excitement caused by this announcement also aided towards that. What an announcement. What a casting choice. Perfect for a show like Arrow. And I got to be honest, I'm almost more excited about the flashbacks this season now than I am about the stuff in Star City.
Well, let's hope that he lives up to your expectations, Greg. I mean, I don't, you know, let's hope that you're not setting yourself up for disappointment. Because as we all know, the flashbacks the last two seasons of Arrow haven't exactly been what one would call compelling.
Right. I liked the flashbacks in season 3, actually, the Katana stuff. I thought that added some drama. They dragged it out a little bit.
Way too long.
But the actual story was good, and I thought it added to Katana's character. This past season, no redeeming qualities. Constantine made an appearance, and that was fun. But other than that,
almost killed every episode. Yes, absolutely. Like, episodes would grind to screeching halts whenever flashbacks started last season.
That's absolutely right. I could not have said it better, Nick. It's played out at this point. To be honest, I don't want them to even have flashbacks anymore, but I understand they have to get through the last one in their eyes. So this should be the last season of flashbacks. I don't like the idea that I've heard of them doing flash forwards in the future. I just want them to be done with flashes. None. Not the Flash, just flashbacks or flash forwards. But I will say this. You add Dolph Lundgren on the damn show, you got my attention. And here's why, Nick. Because Dolph Lundgren's not coming on the show to not do action scenes. So him and Stephen Amell having awesome fight scenes sounds really intriguing to me. I want to see it.
What Greg is saying is that they had his curiosity, but now they have his attention.
I'm not sure I catch the reference.
It's a little Django reference for
you. Oh, that's right. Yes, Django Unchained. Yes. Which there was also a comic book of, apparently, that I didn't read.
No, nor did I.
Anyway,
we should do an entire podcast about comic books we didn't read as opposed to ones
that we know existed.
Yeah. Like, hey, there's one of those Batman Teenage Mutant Ninja Turtle crossover things. That happened. That was a thing.
Yeah.
Yep.
Might have even been good, but I wouldn't know. I haven't read it. Yep.
Prez? That happened. Yep.
The original Prez in the 70s, which had Boss Smiley, who I just found out about today on Twitter. And, boy, you need to look him up, because if ever there was a character designed to be played by Kurt Fuller, it was that character. Kurt Fuller, who Nick would know better as Brell from No Holds Barred.
Anyway, I digress.
Ladies and
gentlemen,
we're going to take a much-needed commercial break. And when we come back for you, we are going to have a look back at The Wicked and the Divine by Kieran Gillen and Jamie McKelvey and Matthew Wilson. So be sure to come back with us right after this.
Promotional consideration paid for by the following.
Voice of Ring of Honor's Kevin Kelly here. I want to make sure you're subscribed to all of our great feeds here at Place to Be Nation. Just head to iTunes today and search and subscribe to the Place to Be podcast feed, the PWO PTBN feed, PTBN Pop, and of course the Kevin Kelly Show feed, which includes the full archives of my podcast. Some really great stuff. Subscribe, listen, and then rate us and leave feedback today. Thanks for being a fan of professional wrestling. More importantly, thanks for being a fan and supporter of the Place to Be Nation.
Place to Be Nation is JT Rizzero here. In addition to the archives of the Kevin Kelly Show, we have a ton of great podcasts available to you on iTunes, Stitcher, Google Play, and PlaceToBeNation.com. And we now offer them to you on two great feeds. On the Place to Be podcast feed, you can check out Scott Criscolo and me on the Mothership, the Place to Be podcast, with our famous Vintage Vault pay-per-view reviews. PTBN also covers current day wrestling with clotheslines and headlines, main event, Mission Indie Possible, and our monthly pay-per-view reaction shows with immediate feedback on WWE, NXT, and Ring of Honor Super Shows. Relive Wrestling's past with our monthly pay-per-view rewind series led by Ben Morse and the Dangerous Alliance Wrestling Podcast as we dive into various subjects in the form of exercises and games. All of this in addition to Scott Keith's Podcast of Doom, which includes discussions on questions from listeners as well as current day and old school wrestling. We also have sports cover too with the Sports Lounge, the TJ McClune Show, and NBA Team Podcast. On our brand new PTB Pop podcast feed, we offer great shows such as the Glenn Butler Podcast Hour Spectacular, Rank and File, Lucha Undead, as well as a veritable podcast heaven for comics fans with the Hard Traveling Fanboys, Sellers Points, Todd Weber's Conversation, and Imaginary Stories. Subscribe to both feeds on iTunes and be sure to rate and leave feedback as well. All of these shows are available on PlayStation.com, where we cover pro wrestling, sports, movies, comics, plus tournaments and more. Be sure to check out the right-hand side of the site for details on how to support the site when you shop at Amazon and download our free Place to Be Vintage Vault Refresh eBooks. We also want to thank our friends at Bonehead's Wing Bar in West Warwick, Rhode Island, and Fall River, Massachusetts, and Scott Keith's Blog of Doom. Be sure to follow us on Facebook, Twitter, Instagram, and Tumblr as well. PlaceToBeNation.com, the only place to be in your pop culture world.
This is Parv, and I'm here to tell you to listen and subscribe to the pro wrestling only Place to Be Nation podcast network. That's the PWO PTBN podcast network, where you'll find a ton of in-depth shows done by hardcore fans. We've got Chris Zellner's 1-2 Punch of Exile on Bad Street, and with David Bickenspan, a smash hit Between the Sheets. We've got Wrestling Culture with Dylan Hales and Dave Musgrave, Goodwill Wrestling and the Reaction Shows with Good Old Will from Texas. We've got This Week in Wrestling with my man Pete and Johnny Sorrow, Stephen Graham and Tim Livingston's Pro Wrestling Super Show, Tag Teams Back Again with Kelly and Marty Sleaze, and a ton of other great shows too. And of course, there's Titans of Wrestling and Where the Big Boys Play with yours truly and some dude from down south called Chad. PWO, PTBN, Podcast Network.
Loyal listeners to our broken brilliance that is the Longbook Hunters. And this month at the Longbook Hunters, we've decided to dust off our monocles, put on our top hats, and look at a critically acclaimed Image Comics title by the terrific creators, writer Kieran Gillen, artist Jamie McKelvey, and colorist Matthew Wilson. It's called The Wicked and the Divine. Or, if you would, The Wicked and the Divine.
Or The Wicked plus the Divine.
Or The Wicked plus the Divine. That's a good point. Good point, ladies and gentlemen. This book came out a couple years ago. The first issue actually dropped in June 2014. We are reviewing the first trade collection called The Faust Act.
Ah, I like it. Pun. The Faust Act. Get it?
Oh, get it? I never got that. My God, the whole time. I've never gotten that. Good point, Nick.
Oh,
I award myself no points, and may I burn in hell.
And may God have mercy on your soul.
Yes. Anyhow, all that being said, this is indeed a comic book. And it's a very well-acclaimed book. It's won numerous awards. It's got a huge Twitter following. People love it. Nick, how did you first hear about this book, this series? What was your first exposure to it?
I saw some issues on the shelves at the local shop a couple times, and then also, you know, this was, you said it came out in 2014, correct?
Mm-hmm. First issue did, yeah.
So I can't remember the exact timing of it, but this book was fairly early on in its run, or perhaps even the first issue came out after Kieran Gillen had started his Star Wars run. I can't really remember. They were relatively close to each other in time. And so, his Darth Vader run, I should say, excuse me. And so I had really taken notice of him for that, and also some other Marvel stuff I had read of his that I had enjoyed. He had done some work on Thor that I read, you know, after the fact that I really liked. So I was really aware of the art, of the creator first, the writer, and then saw that it was starting to get a lot of critical acclaim, getting really big, really great reviews, and I read some of the plot synopses, you know, of basically describing the premise of the book, which, and you've read it more recently than I have, so feel free to correct me if I'm incorrect on any of this, but my understanding of, or based on my memory, was that the premise revolves around a group of gods who periodically are sent to Earth to live as humans, and they live on Earth for a number of years, and then they die, and
100 years.
For 2 years, then for 100 years later or whatever the
99
number
years
is,
later, yep.
99 years later, they come back and live another 2 years.
Yeah, 90 years.
And then they die again.
Right.
And so it was this cycle of death and rebirth, which, as you know, appeals to me being a big Thor fan. So I was like, all right, well, I'll probably check that out at some point. And then one of my close friends, Hope, who works for Second and Charles, went to San Diego Comic-Con each of the past 2 years, and during her first trip, she was able to actually meet Kieran Gillen and get him to sign a copy of this book, and so she lent it to me whenever she got back because I hadn't read it, and she was a big fan. So that's kind of my history with the book and where I first came in contact with it.
Yeah, and I had heard about it for a long time, mainly through Twitter. A lot of the people I follow on Twitter are huge fans of this. The hashtag WickDiv followers who always kind of tweet about the new issues when they come out. So I knew a little bit about it. I never knew what it was about. I had an idea, but honestly, the idea of what I thought it was about was not actually what it was about. As you laid out, that's pretty accurate to what it is. The main difference being that it's not that gods are necessarily reborn every 90 years. It's that they're actually normal people every 90 years who are chosen to merge with the reborn spirit of these deities. So the god inhabits the human form, but they're destined to die in 2 years. And then it's another 90 years before the gods can come back and inhabit new forms. Really cool premise, I thought, anyway. I thought it was – I think it's one of the coolest premises that I've heard in a while. It's kind of playing on some of the soft spots that I have for those kind of comics that touch on divinity a little bit. Preacher, for instance, being an example of that. It also touched on a little bit of the mortality elements of Why the Last Man, the idea of, you know, pretty much knowing that the world is going to die out pretty soon. In this case, it's only individuals knowing that about themselves. But similar thematic concepts.
And it also had, you know, given the modern context, because at least the first volume anyway, pretty much entirely focuses on the most recent version of these gods that have come onto Earth. And the idea is that in the past they had been worshipped in small cults that were kind of kept on the down low or whatever, but how would gods interact with society in the era of social media where, you know, everything is broadcast essentially as soon as it happens, and, you know, word can spread so quickly and things go viral or people gain online followings for no particular reason at all and things like that. So it kind of explores some of those themes of you know, the consequence of fame and popularity in the modern age as well.
Yeah, it's gods as pop stars, essentially.
Essentially, yes.
What would happen if gods were treated – if gods inhabited a world in which Paris Hilton is a household name? So, you know, it's a very interesting thematic.
Greg is showing his age there with Paris Hilton.
I don't know.
Who's a pop icon poll?
Who are the pop icons today, Mr. So Much Younger Than Me?
The Kardashians, probably.
Oh, the Kardashians, huh? Listen, the only Kardashian I know is the one that was on OJ's team.
Robert Kardashian. Something tells me that you've seen some of the work of a certain other Kardashian.
Well, quite,
but we'll,
quite
well,
frankly,
that's neither here
that's
nor
neither
there.
Neither here nor there, ladies and gentlemen. Anyway, our main character in this story is a teenager, Laura Wilson. She is not a member of this group called the Pantheon, who are these gods that inhabit these human forms every 90 years. She's not a member of this. However, She is essentially a wannabe.
A groupie, if you will.
A groupie, yeah. That's a good point. She's a groupie. She looks up to these deities and wants to be them, essentially. Wants to be exactly like them. Wants to have their better to burn out than fade away mentality. To have their power, to have their fame, their stardom. She is obsessed with them, essentially, knows everything about them. She's our main character, our viewpoint character, our Kitty Pryde, if you will, to this greater universe. The gods themselves, in this volume, the Faust Act, the main, I would say, god character is actually the devil.
Lucifer, yes.
Who
has taken the form of a woman known as Lucy.
Yes. And Lucy is the god character you get to interact with the most in this whole doohickey, in this whole premise, so to speak.
Yeah, and that's one thing I think we should clarify is when we say god characters, this is not strictly from a Judeo-Christian set of beliefs. It seems to be pulling from a variety of you know, inspirations, a variety of belief structures from around the world, maybe some pagan influence, I would say, here.
Yes, I mean, we see some characters that are mentioned in the Bible, like Baal, the bull god, I guess you would say. I don't even know if that's a bull god or not, actually, but I remember Baal being referenced in the Bible. Baphomet, you know, you see these characters, you see Greek characters, Dionysus, you see the Valkyries. You know, you get a lot of these different myths, different characters from around the world, from different ideologies and belief structures, and they all seem to know each other and have relationships with one another, even if those relationships are antagonistic in nature. So very interesting premise. The plot of this particular first act is actually a murder mystery, which was kind of cool.
No. The Faust Act, Greg.
Very good. It's actually a murder mystery, which is pretty cool. There's a sort of the character of Lucifer, Lucy. She breaks the code of the gods because the gods are not supposed to reveal their powers in public. They're not supposed to harm humans in any way. However, this group of humans who are seeking to expose the fraudulent deities try to, you know, gun them down at a party, and so Lucy goes and takes them out with a snap of her fingers, blows up their head, basically. So she's taken to court. I'm never quite 100% sure why she allows herself to be taken to court, but she does allow herself to be taken to court, and as she's sitting in trial kind of mocking the judge's head explodes. However, she swears she didn't do it, even though it fits the exact way that she killed the snipers before. So that sets us out on a pretty big journey. And I'm sorry for that spoiler, guys. That'll be the only spoiler I give, believe me. It sets us up on a really big character murder arc for the entire first volume here. And it weaves and it winds. And to be honest, it kind of drags a little bit at times. Yeah. But it does have its cool moments and ends up in a pretty shocking twist at the end that I'm not going to reveal for you. But suffice to say, the murder mystery is probably going to be a centerpiece for the series going forward, I would imagine, in future volumes. But before we get into the actual, you know, how we thought about the plot and the structure, I wanted to start out and talk about the art from Jamie McKelvey, because I have never actually been exposed, to my knowledge, to Jamie McKelvey's art. But it is absolutely phenomenal. This is one of the most beautiful books that I've read in quite some time. Maybe ever. I mean, the facial expressions are...
I was about to say, that's one thing. It's been a little while since I read the book, but I remember the facial expressions sticking out. Because you've got a book that is essentially... There are no costumes. There's very little superhero... There's no superheroes to speak of. So you've got to really be able to convey emotion. You've got to be able to draw the human form. And McKelvey does an amazing job with facial expressions where you know how every character is feeling in a scene, even if it's not said out loud. You know, it's a fantastic job on his part.
Absolutely. It's almost to the point where you can tell what's going on even without the dialogue.
Yes.
Which is rare in comics. It's absolutely phenomenal art. I don't know if he's interested in doing superhero work. I don't know if he has done superhero work. I'm interested in reading it because this is just phenomenal. It's beautiful. The colors from Matthew Wilson, the colors in this book are phenomenal. absolutely amazing. I can't say enough about the art. I think it's one of the best books on the stands in terms of art that I've seen, you know, in a long time, a long, long time. But
absolutely. To answer your question, he has done some work for Marvel. He's done some Defenders, some X-Men, a little bit of Young Avengers. I'm seeing here a little bit of Cable.
That's right. He worked with Kieran Gillen on Young Avengers, if I'm not mistaken.
He did. He did. Some Invincible Iron Man. So various Marvel projects. No DC projects that I see other than something called Gotham Gazette, which yes. I'm not even sure what that is.
Anyway, this art team of McKelvey and Wilson, they need to basically be doing a bunch of books because they're incredible. Now, the story itself is actually really, really interesting. They do a great job of introducing these new God characters, and every chapter introduces at least one new character to the story that we haven't met before.
Oftentimes more than one, though. That's one complaint I will have is it was throwing a lot of characters at you at one time at various points.
And a lot of names. A lot of really hard-to-pronounce names.
And see, it's been a couple months since I read it, so a lot of those names are starting – those names and characters are starting to run together. Like, if you describe to me actions that the characters took, I could probably – I can distinguish them that way. But assigning names to faces and that kind of stuff, outside of probably Lucy and the Morrigan and Baphomet and Lara, of course, I couldn't really probably pick the rest of them out of the lineup.
Yeah, the most memorable chapter, I think, of this first volume – other than the initial chapter that ends in the murder mystery, was probably the one that had Baphomet and the Morrigan, where yes. it appeared as if Baphomet had decapitated the Morrigan before we ever met her. And just a really, really good chapter with good character interactions.
My own personal backstory that I've invented for the Morrigan is that she is Grant Morrison's own personal god that he says in his Scottish accent.
The Morrigan?
I don't know why.
Knows it's the Morrigan.
Yep, that's just the way
like
I like to think of it.
The Morrigan has an awesome character too because she's got like basically three different personalities inhabiting the same body, which is really cool. I think I'm a sucker for that premise in general, hence why I'm excited for Legion. But you know, Ball is a cool character too. You know, there's a lot of interesting interactions and interesting. Ebb and flow throughout the course of the story. What did you think about the pacing and the plot in this one?
In terms of pacing, I think I agree with you is that it did drag at times. Like, it felt like they were artificially extending the murder mystery just to introduce more characters that I'm assuming will play larger roles in the series to date, you know, down the road. Whereas I feel like they probably could have wrapped up that murder mystery to begin with and then saved some of those character introductions for the second official story arc rather than trying to fit those into the first arc as well. So thought the pacing was a little slow at times for my taste, but overall, you know, the plot was interesting. It kept me interested, and at the end of the day, I'm certainly intrigued and looking forward to seeing where the story goes from the end of volume one.
Yeah, I definitely thought it dragged in the middle chapters a little bit, that Morrigan chapter being an exception, but there were times when there was just it was a lot of information they're throwing
they
at
do,
you.
They do some work with Morrigan and Baphomet in issues 2 and 3, and then issues 4 and 5, or issue 4 in particular, I think, was where it kind of dragged before it ramped up for the conclusion.
Yeah, I would agree with that. And you know, it's an interesting plot. It's a great premise. I'm not sure that I ever felt the book really lived up to the premise, but this is where we're going to get into some controversial territory, folks, because I'm setting myself up for a lot of blowback on this because I know this is a very popular book. People love it, and I don't blame them for loving it. This is where I'm going to, for the first time ever, I'm going to give a comic book the "It's Not You, It's Me" talk. Wicked and the Divine is like this.
This is the first time Greg's ever actually gotten to give anything this talk, so let's play it out.
That's a great point. Now, Wicked and the Divine is like this. You're beautiful. You're absolutely beautiful. You're stunning. You're radiant. You light up a room when you're on a shelf. Hell, you're really interesting. You know, you got a lot going for you. You got a great future ahead of you. Multiple volumes in the future. You'll breed offspring, probably offshoots even. And it'll be great. And you'll have a wonderful family. people who love you, people who cling to you. But I have needs too. And I've realized that I'm just not worthy. I'm just not the kind of person that you need in your readership right now. I'm just too set in my ways, Wicked and the Divine. I need to have a story that has at least one character I can latch on to, a likable character, a character who I root for. And Wicked and the Divine, the problem with you is not you. It's just my preference for what I want out of stories. It's happened before in films. It's happened before with music. It's happened before in all kinds of realms of media. I have certain things that I have to have, and if I don't get those specific things, to use a Place to Be Nation favorite reference, I'm like Jerry Seinfeld, and I'm just going to find that one thing that's enough to turn me off. And in this case, I just didn't like any of your characters as far as wanting to root for them. In fact, I wanted them all to be decapitated.
Even the Morgan and Baphomet, who were fun to read?
Yes. Even the Morgan and Baphomet. Well, the Morgan and Baphomet were interesting to read. They're interesting characters. I thought they were very interesting characters. I was interested to read more about them, but I wasn't rooting for them, no. I think that's the problem, is like, yes, they were interesting, but again, I was lacking that rooting interest in the protagonist of the book. You know, I've read plenty of books that had a bunch of unlikable people, but even in Watchmen, everybody has a character that they attach to in Watchmen. For me, it was Rorschach, particularly the first
one. Or Rorschach.
Or Rorschach, if you will. You look at Sin City, and you've got Marv. You look at Preacher, Hardigan. And you've got Jesse. Now, Jesse's not perfect. Jesse's got plenty of things about him that make him kind of an asshole. But you still root for him. And I didn't – at the end of this issue, I feel like the book wants me to root for Laura, and instead I found her completely unlikable.
Right. I would imagine that part of the story of the book will be her growth as a character from annoying groupie into something more, given the events of the last issue, but I can't say that for sure, having not read the
I'm sure that's part of it, because I mean it's one of those things where I don't really feel bad for her in any way. I feel like she's unfairly harsh to her parents. I feel like she thinks she's a lot smarter than she is, as all teenagers do. She's basically a really annoying teenager, and it's hard for me to identify with really annoying teenagers. I mean, I was once a really annoying teenager, so I know what it's like to be one, and I didn't like myself then. So that's kind of my issue with it. I acknowledge objectively this is a good book. I'd recommend people to give it a try. Subjectively, I just could not – it's not that I disliked it. It's that I couldn't get hooked to it. It didn't make me want to really explore future volumes because there wasn't that hook. It wasn't like The Authority where there was things that I didn't like about it, but it hooked me and I wanted to find out more about it. It was kind of the opposite, where it was pretty good and didn't really have any really bad elements. It's just that it didn't do anything to really capture my imagination and make me want to read more. If you're just doing a Morgan and Baphomet play weird sex games with each other book, maybe I'd read that, but I don't know. It was
read it. You'd read it for 90 seconds at a time, I'm sure.
Well, it depends on how short the issue is. But you know, they were interesting, but it was just, this book is one that I would again recommend trying out, see if it's for you. A lot of people love it. It's beautiful, but it's not one that I'm probably going to be continuing with in the future.
Yeah, I can agree with most of those criticisms. For me, I am interested in picking up more of it for a couple reasons. The art, as you previously mentioned, and two, as I told you offline, to me, it's one of those books where the premise of it is just so strong that even if I don't love the execution in the first act, the Faust act, I am willing to give it a shot because I really feel like that premise and those themes are so interesting to me that I'm willing to see how subsequent volumes handle it. So I would recommend the book overall. I'd give it, you know, I don't know if we want to put a number on it or anything like that, but I'd say probably a 7 or a 7.5 out of 10. I will say that I agree with you, and I think it's just a tad bit overrated, but that's only because of all the critical praise that's been heaped on it for the last 2 years. But still, a very, very good book, and a book that has me interested to read more at some point in the undetermined future when I have time to just sit down and read things that are on my to-do list.
Yes, very good. So we have a little bit of disagreement here. I did recommend people to give it a try. I would go lower if I were doing a number. I don't know. Maybe for me personally, maybe 5.5 out of 10, something like that. You know, like, not, again, it sounds like I'm bashing the book. It just didn't hook me personally. But again, objectively, it's well written, it's well drawn. Can't fault any of that. But you know, just not my cup of tea, not my cuppa, as our buddy Tim might say. And you know, not every.
I've literally never heard him say that.
He said it online a few times. But, you know, different strokes for different folks. Not everything's going to be for everybody. So,
and it does indeed take different strokes to move the world.
All right. And the –
Woo!
Yes. So with all that being said, folks, you can find The Wicked and the Divine most likely at your local comic book shop. You can find it on Amazon. You can find it in a number of places if you're so interested. This creative team – deserves credit for you know, coming up with this idea and coming up with this cool premise. But that'll wrap it up for our talk about The Wicked and the Divine. And what do we have coming people's way soon? Well, we've got a big project coming your way, folks, here in about, oh, how many weeks, Nick? I don't know.
4 or 5 weeks, I think, something
four
like
five
that.
5 weeks. We've got a
the final week of September is the slated launch date for.
It's appropriate you said final, because it very well may be the final podcast in Place to Be Nation pop history.
It will be our own final deletion.
Yes, delete. What we wanted to do. Perhaps one might argue, but nonetheless. We will have for you, well, we're going to have something coming your way. We're going to have something that's going to...
Oh, come on, guys. Let's just go ahead now and
all right.
Start the build.
You may remember the wildly popular Place to Be Nation Fantasy Comics Draft of 2014?
Yes.
And in that, we The staff of Place to Be Nation Comics, at that time we were all columnists, and we got together and we did a fantasy sports style draft of comic book writers, artists, and characters, started our own fictional comic companies, and then wrote out fictitious pitches for fictitious books starring our fictitious creative teams.
Yes.
Ladies and gentlemen, it does not get a whole lot nerdier than that.
Nope.
So naturally, we thought, let's up the ante a little bit. And so we decided to bring in a new member, Stephanie Holly, to our old clique. And we decided to do a live, yes, folks, live comic book fantasy draft. And do it via podcast. We had a clock and everything.
Such as it was,
to some would say varying degrees of success. And, well, Nick and I hosted it, and, you know, as hosts, we take both the credit and the blame.
Yes, absolutely.
And thus, ladies and gentlemen, you're about to be exposed here in a few weeks to, quite frankly, some might say a time-honored tradition in this podcasting business, which is a podcast that goes off the rails.
Yes. And that podcast is, of course, the second biennial Place to Be Nation Pop Peter David Memorial Fantasy Comics Draft, presented by a hypothetical DC Comics Online unlimited subscription service.
Indeed, and if all goes to plan, this draft podcast, when it drops, will be accompanied not long thereafter by our wonderful, wondrous Fantasy Comics pitches, which are certain to be detailed and entertaining. Actually, I will say this. If you go to placetobenation.com and you look through the archives and you find our fantasy pitches from the last one, I actually recently went back and reread them. They're really good. They're really entertaining. So I would recommend any of you out there to go find that, read it. Some will make you laugh. Some will make you intrigued. And some of those ideas have actually been used in the actual comics since then. I don't know. I wonder who it might have been that might have had an idea like that. Must have been a decent guy. Fair.
Curiouser and curiouser. What idea are you referring to, by the way?
Oh, to be honest, I thought it was one of yours.
Oh, the Damian Wayne leading the Teen Titans?
Yes.
Thing? Yeah, well, I mean, that was going to happen at some point anyway. Now, if in the course of the book they reveal that he has a certain romantic interest in a certain female archer that is related to a certain Oliver Queen, then I will take full credit for that one.
Well, I have a little birdie told me that, quite frankly, one of the other drafters in this tournament, in this competition, may have been inspired by another drafter's previous pitch idea for a title. But that's just what I heard. I may be wrong. That's just what some might say.
Quite frankly, I'd suggest that one comic company is in the comic book business, and I
wait on this one.
Excuse me. Ho Ho Wow Comics is in the entertainment business.
I'll never forget that day you called me. Ho Ho Wow Comics called. Whatever the hell the name of my comic book company was, and you said, Greg, we're in the comic book business, and you fired two pistols in the air, and I said, well, Ho Ho Wow Comics publisher Nicholas Duke, that's fine, I'm in the entertainment business.
Two different businesses.
Yeah, I've never even heard of that business. I'm sorry. Comic books are what my father did. We do graphic novels.
What are we even doing?
On that one the whole time I've been doing these podcasts. Wonderful. Anyway, so we got that coming your way. Next week, we have the much anticipated, always looked forward to return of Tim Capel.
Yes.
To count down our top five Marvel Comics crossover events. And this is going to be a good one. It's going to be a trip down
memory. Greg is going to deliver the rest of the podcast in a Triple H promo-like fashion, apparently.
Because I have been waiting for 15 years to talk about Executioner's Song. And it's going to happen on our podcast.
Well, Scott Crisello just canceled us, so thanks for that.
I thought he might have been a little excited by that, but that's neither here nor there. But we got that coming your way, ladies and gentlemen. We've got a cavalcade of content coming your way. We've got Iron Man down the pipe, or Iron Man, if you will, to kick off our Hard Travelers for Hire series, requested by one of our listeners. So be on the lookout for that. All that being said, I can't think of anything else to add. Go out and read The Wicked and Divine. Give us your thoughts on it. Let us know what you think about it. And go to Place to Be Nation Comics Facebook page to talk to us about that. That's where most of our discussion takes place. You can also find us on Twitter. I am at gphillips8652. He is at nickduke87. We tweet comic book opinions. We tweet wrestling stuff. Nick posts weird pictures of old Georgia players from the 50s. you can catch all kinds of
it's
things
on Twitter account. For the record, it is a countdown to the first game of the season, sir.
So it is. And with all that being said, go find us on Twitter. Find us on Place to Be Nation Comics, Facebook. Send us an email if people still do that. Greg P. at placetobenation.com. Nick D. at placetobenation.com. And if you have any suggestions for the show, please let us know. If you want things, you want us to do things different, add content to the show, delete content from the show. Do you want more impressions? Do you want less impressions?
Do you want less cold medicine involved in your show?
More
whatever you want
involved in your show? I mean,
oh God, let's not do that.
No, what do you want from us, folks? Do you want us both to be on illicit substances? Just let us know what you want from us, and we will do it. And I'm just floating this out there. If any of our loyal listeners would like to make any financial contributions to the Hard Charlie Fanboys, we are open to those as well. Contact us any of the previously mentioned ways.
Somebody should make us a theme song. That's what they should do.
David Sunday has actually has actually talked about that, that he has been working on concepts for our theme song. So we'll see.
I like it.
Turns out. That's loyal.
Does it have to do anything with when it comes crashing down and it happens to cause pain inside? Is there any of that?
I doubt it, given his knowledge base of said product. But I think it may have something to do with Yab Dab. So we'll have to get to that.
Which, of course, that's a lyric lifted directly from the song Ragdoll by the band Aerosmith.
That's correct. He loves the comic Batman. Anyway, we're finished with our end jokes for this week, folks. Hope you somewhat enjoyed our abbreviated look at the Wicked and the Divine. And we'll be back next week. We hope you'll be back with us. Take care, everyone. Nick, any final message for the listeners out there?
Yeah!